This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega, race and inequality reporter from CNN and CNN Money, sitting in for Todd Zwillick. Thanks so much for being here with us. We begin this hour thinking about what it means to experience discrimination in America. It turns out most Americans feel their own racial or ethnic group faces some kind of discrimination today. That's according to a new poll about race and identity in America, and that same poll revealed something that took many by surprise. A majority of white Americans surveyed said whites in the United States face discrimination today. NPR, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and the T.H. Chan School of Public Health at Harvard surveyed just over 3,400 adults of all backgrounds. Of those, 902 were white, and 55% of that group of white Americans reported feeling discriminated against. We put this question to our white listeners. Do you feel discriminated against because of your race? And the majority of you said no.
My name is Kim from Pleasanton, and as a white person, I can say with certainty that white people have no idea what discrimination is.
Kylie from Orlando. I've never been discriminated in my life.
Sarah calling from Gainesville, Florida.
No, I do not agree. I recognize the privileges that I have from being white, not having to worry when a cop pulls me over that he'll shoot me. I think they use discrimination against them to scapegoat their economic or social losses.
But some of you said, yes, I do experience discrimination.
My name is John. I'm from Ashtabula, Ohio. I've been discriminated against for being white. I took the test to get in the fire department. I scored highest of everyone taking the test. I was told I didn't get the job because they wanted a minority. I took the civil service test to become a postman. I got points for being a veteran, but the African American sitting next to me got more points just because of his color. Yes, I've been discriminated against, and it happens all the time.
For some context around these issues, we turn to Dr. LaRue Lewis-McCoy, an associate professor of sociology and black studies at the City College of New York and author of the book Inequality in the Promised Land. Dr. LaRue Lewis-McCoy, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me on.
So let's unpack this. I mean, I cover this. I write about this. I live it. I'm a person of color. This idea that white people can be discriminated against or can experience discrimination, let's start with that. Is that even possible within how we define discrimination today?
I think the idea that white people can be discriminated against is possible and actually makes sense. Now, of course, discrimination is treatment based on another set of identities or the leveraging of power against someone. But it's important to recognize that oftentimes, as white Americans may experience discrimination, the magnitude of discrimination and the frequency of discrimination looks very different than people of color, particularly African American and Latino folks. So when white Americans start to say, we have been discriminated against, it may represent one, two, three experiences of discrimination. When you compare that to the experiences of African Americans, who on average may experience five dimensions of discrimination and everyday hassles, then we realize that we're talking about really a different beast.
So is this this idea of reverse racism, is that what we're talking about here, or is that different from the discrimination we're describing?
Reverse racism falls into the category of discrimination, particularly for many white people who think about their experiences. So one of the listeners highlighted being passed over in a firefighter exam in a civil service test in which he identified the African-American sitting next to him got more points on the entrance exam. Now, I'm not sure how he knows that information or if that information is accurate, but he's taken that experience to be real, to be truthful, and to actually suggest that it changed his life circumstances. We often don't think about, when we talk about reverse discrimination around things like affirmative action, how frequent discrimination towards people who are black and brown and poor happens. And so when people have their first experience where they think they have been mistreated, whether it is legitimate or illegitimate, they see that as the only experience that matters. They don't see that someone who grows up in a community that has high rates of poverty, that have schools that have been failing, that don't offer AP courses, their lack of access to educational opportunity are actually the discrimination that matters most in providing access to jobs or equal pay.
Dr. Lewis-McCoy, yesterday I spoke with one listener named Jonathan.
I hate bringing race or anything into this, but if you are a white Christian male, in these days, you are demonized.
He didn't want to use his last name. He's 32, white, from Beaverton, Oregon, and he says he feels discriminated against.
when I first actually heard about this idea, we were at a rally in Portland, and this white kid, maybe college age, runs up and starts telling my Japanese mixed friend, that he knows he was born racist because he's white, and he accepts that, and he feels guilty for it, and he apologizes. And then he calls my friends racist. I've heard that multiple times since, and I sat there thinking to myself, well, I'm white, I'm not racist, I don't feel bad about anything. What? And I've heard it from women, from dudes, and now it seems to be some kind of theme that is accepted, and if you don't accept it, you're a racist.
So what you're saying is, I just want to make sure I understand, that you personally feel hurt because as a white Christian male, you feel that people think you are a racist, just off the bat.
Correct. Instantly. And through that, they won't want to listen to you. They assume the worst of you.
Have you experienced any specific discrimination outside of the example that you just gave me? Like, have you experienced it on the job? Have you experienced it at other points in your life?
I've experienced mainly at the Portland events. This is a very crazy town when we go out to do freedom rallies. I've been maced, spit on, told to shut up, told that I'm worthless. The first time was when I was around 15 or 16. There was a Hispanic girl that lived down the street. You know, we were friends at school. She was cool. We were all friends. But then every time she got home, you know, she wasn't allowed to come out and hang out or do anything with the other neighbors. You know, they were mostly white. And then she had her quinceañera, and she invited me, and she really, really wanted me to go. And I was a little nervous, you know, 15, I don't know Spanish, and you know, I don't know what the food's going to be like. And then I get there, I finally get the nerve to show up, and all the Mexican kids my age shunned me. Like, they physically tried to intimidate me out. And at the time, I didn't really think of it as racism. Maybe it was a cultural thing, but that was the first time that I had an experience with, because of my skin color, I'm lower or I'm not welcome.
So, Jonathan, what do you think about, I mean, because when we think about discrimination in this country, for black and brown Americans, feeling discriminated against is sort of an everyday experience for many of them. Do you think that that's not the case?
I don't know anyone that discriminates against anyone. I'm not saying it doesn't happen. I've only met one or two actual racist people my whole life.
Actual racist, what do you mean? What do you mean when you say actual racist?
Oh, white people should stick to white people. You know, everyone should stick to their own. They were older gentlemen, and they admitted to being racist. They weren't hiding something. They weren't trying to bait me into being racist. They were just, yeah, I don't like that color. They should stick to their own type.
And you don't identify like that, do you?
No, I do not agree with any Nazi stuff or racist or anything like that.
Dr. Lewis McCoy, why do whites feel so on average, I guess, in this poll, so discriminated against and so on edge about being considered racist?
Well, one of the most dangerous words in our vocabulary is the word racist or racism, because somehow in 2017, we've gotten rid of all of the racists except for a handful of people who have outright hatred and bigotry towards another group. Now, as a sociologist, I know that racism is not about individual feelings. It's much more about institutional power. And so when you have someone like Jonathan who says, well, I've been called racist and white people are labeled racist, which in fact makes other folks who call them racist, racist, we start to realize that the meaning of the word has been diluted and changed around. One of the things that they also found in the survey that I thought was really telling was they asked white Americans, if you've been discriminated against, what do you think matters more? Is it individual discrimination, or do you think it's governmental and institutional policies? And 61% of white folks said it's definitely all about individual discrimination. Only a quarter of white respondents said the government policies are discriminatory and maybe racist. Now, this is particularly dangerous because the bulk of discrimination that African Americans face, that Latinos face, and other people face doesn't come from interpersonal interaction daily, someone walking up and saying, I dislike you because of your background or speak English today. Instead, it happens in the ways in which they're not incorporated into the fabric of American life.
So you're talking more about covert racism.
Right. I'm talking about covert, but I'm talking about institutions. What kind of schools you have access to when you are born black and Latino? What kind of hospitals you have access to? So really, unfortunately, most of our discourse around racism, and part of it is connected to us emphasizing things like Charlottesville, where we can identify the, quote, real racist who marched around with tiki torches. I'm much less worried about people marching around with tiki torches in Charlottesville than I am with government officials who are cutting funding to key areas such as HUD.
What's also stunning to me in this is that we have more information perhaps now than we ever had, we being media consumers, media creators. We've seen things because of social media and technology. We're seeing things that perhaps were never seen before in terms of violence against communities of color. I'm thinking Michael Brown, you know, and on, and the videos that we've seen. So these ideas that this is hidden behind, you know, this is just happening in certain communities and no one knows about it is false today. I mean, I think because it's so obvious, because we've seen so much of this, how can we still have that cognitive dissonance between seeing what's getting played out on air in social media and in our daily lives and still refusing to sort of grapple with that? It just seems like we've been in this place for quite a while, and it doesn't seem to be changing.
Yeah, I think we've been in this place for quite a while, but I actually do think it's changing. It's getting a little bit worse because it's getting worse for a particular reason. We live in segregated housing and we have segregated schooling experiences and segregated relationships. And so people don't often see discrimination unless it's played out in their life. They make exceptions for the things at a distance and they're like, well, maybe they did something wrong. But now when you add in the influence of a thing like social media, which often spreads information but can spread actively misinformation, particularly for white Americans who receive information about gun violence, for white Americans who receive information about Antifa, they are seeing themselves under threat and they're able to pull from often misinformation to say, we are the true victims now. Well, where'd you get your information from? I got it from Facebook. I got it from my Twitter feed. And this misinformation has also been in the form of mainstream media. So now I think we're in a similar place, but often a more dangerous place.
How much of this is about feeling threatened, if you will, with a loss of power? And when I say that, I say, you know, let's look back at the past decade where we had our first black president. We saw many gains, you know, small and hard-earned gains, but gains nonetheless in terms of some sort of racial equity or confirmation of the fact that these things are happening and continue to exist. Is this about changing the power structure of this country, changing the tenor of race in this country and the discomfort that comes with that? Essentially, you know, if this country, and we know that it is getting browner every day, is this a reaction to that?
I definitely think a lot of this is a reaction to the threat of the browning of the country, but also the fear of losing power. And this, what we're often experiencing are the last gasp of what we call white supremacy as an ideology, which is the idea that those who have control, who have power, who are deserving of things are white. Now, most people won't identify as such, but when we see the distribution of goods, when there's so much income and wealth distributed towards white Americans, we see that people are saying, well, what happens if this power shifts? Now, as demographics change, we may see a browning of America. But what we don't often see is a change in power, and that political power is how we have to look at racism. And if we start to seriously do an analysis of who's in control of major institutions and whose interests are they acting on behalf of, we start to see, well, the demographic threat may appear to be real, as in we are getting less white, but the shift of power is not occurring. So we have to push back against this fear and these threats and really create a more equitable and true country that meets the ideals that were set forth that have never fully been the reality of American citizenship.
I think, you know, also I agree. And I think when you look at when we talk about power, particularly in the United States, particularly in a capitalist society, that power is connected to wealth usually. And some of the numbers that I got for a project that I was working on from the St. Louis Fed about a year ago indicated that of the wealthiest Americans, the top 1% of Americans, about 95% of that top 1% are white, which leaves the remaining percentage filled with people of color, whether they be Asian, Latino, black, et cetera. So when we look at that, when we look at the concentration of wealth, when we look at the concentration of power in our federal government even, whites still dominate. And now is this an economic question, right? Are these largely and we heard a lot about this group during the election cycle, the sort of white working class who are struggling with opioid addiction, who are struggling with unemployment. Is this that resentment coming from that?
There is a dimension of class, but far too much of the resistance to racial change a fear of a Browning of America has been placed on the white working class. And they've been seen as the people who are leading this movement. But when we look at things like who voted for Donald Trump, we see across the economic spectrum, and particularly those who are white and affluent, voted for Trump at disproportionate rates. So there is an economic tail as well. And part of it is that we think, well, if you are white and working class, you have it hard in America. You do, but when we look at things like wealth, we see that the white working class, on average, have more wealth than the black middle class. So what that tells you is that how power is wielded today is it's really an intergenerational narrative, and it's who receives the spoils. And historically and contemporarily, black and Latino folks are not receiving an equal share. So while poor white Americans may feel their situation is hard, and while they may experience the downsizing of industrialization and other things, their conditions on average still outpace those who are black and Latino and actually getting, quote unquote, getting ahead in America.
And if I recall correctly, a couple of years ago, was it Diva Pager at Harvard did a study that showed that whites with a criminal history were more likely to be hired or called back than blacks without a criminal history, if I recall that study correctly. So there still seem to be these big gaps in how we're treated. One question for you, too. One of the things that came up in the interview with Jonathan was that when I asked him, you know, did he ever fear for his life when he had been in, you know, come into contact with law enforcement, had been pulled over by the cops?
I've been pulled over a ton of times. I lost my license for 3 years when I was 18.
And what have those what have those interactions been like?
Depends on how I reacted. If I was cocky, they were a little bit meaner. If I was cooperative, everything was smooth. It was really just how I approached them.
Did you ever fear for your life?
I've had a gun drawn on me before, but no, I wasn't scared. I had my hands on the steering wheel. Never feared for my life, no. And I've had a lot of police contact, because after I drove, my license was suspended for 3 years, I still drove and drove and drove. So I was getting pulled over a couple times a week.
So Jonathan, I think that's one of the differences between white and black Americans in particular, is how the rate with which police use force on African Americans is almost four times higher than the rate of white Americans.
I disagree with that, because if I would have got out of the car and ran, they would have chased me. And then once they caught me, depending on how much of a struggle, they're going to put their knee on the back of my head. They're going to wrap my wrist up. They're going to twist my leg, just like they're going to do to anyone who runs or who doesn't want to be cooperative. But I don't think the police officers wake up and be like, today I'm going to go get black people.
Dr. Lewis McCoy, when I hear these you know, reasons, it feels very paternalistic almost. It feels like, well, black and brown people just need to behave better and not get out of line, right? And yet we have white Americans who are sort of, you know, allowed to express the full dimension of their racial discomfort here. But it doesn't seem that that seems to be allowed on the flip side, if that makes sense. I mean,
it does. It makes perfect sense. Oftentimes when we talk about feeling like you are mistreated, people may become angry. But we are now at a point where black people, Latino folks, are not allowed to be angry. We have to be the perfect citizens to survive in everyday life. And that's a very dangerous and unrealistic proposition. I wasn't even 20 years old the first time that I found myself with a police officer pulling me over with his gun drawn. This is not a world that we want to live in. Instead of asking black folks, Latino folks, poor folks to be superhuman and be perfect, we have to look at those who have power and say, why are you pulling over different sets of folks? It's not a question of who's driving while black. It's a question of who's policing while white. We have to reorient our frames and make sure that we're not asking for superhuman ability, but we're really creating opportunities for people to live their lives free of harm and free of the fear of losing their life daily.
Dr. LaRue Lewis McCoy, Associate Professor of Sociology and Black Studies at the City College of New York and author of the book Inequality in the Promised Land. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to The Takeaway. This is Tanzina Vega in for Todd Zwillick.